Welcome to episode 43 of Leading People with me, Jerry Murray. This episode is brought to you by Wide Circle, helping you make better talent decisions. To learn more, visit widecircle.eu. That's widecircle.eu. My guest this week is Larry English, president and co-founder of Centric Consulting, a management consultancy that helps firms find solutions to complex digital business and technology problems. In the early 2000s, Larry and some like-minded friends founded Centric with a vision to create a remote company with a mission to create a culture of employee and client happiness. Today, Centric employs over 1,000 people. With all that experience, Larry knows a thing or two about how to build and sustain a connected culture with virtual teams, and he's captured all of this in his latest book. So, without further ado, let's dive right in and listen to what Larry has to say. Larry English, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
So, Larry, I came across your book a few months back, and I just thought this is truly a topic for our times, and I really wanted to get you on the show. So I reached out to you, and then eventually I had the courage to say, okay, would you like to be a guest on my leading podcast as we now into the new season? But before we talk about the book itself, I mean, often listeners like to find out a little bit about the author and that. So how did you get here? What person, place, or an event stands out on your journey to where you got to today? Or was there some sort of epiphany moment that kind of shaped this whole journey that you've been on, particularly around the area of remote working, et cetera?
Yeah. And so I'll give you two of those exact moments. So I went out of college, I went to work for one of the big international consulting firms, which was great, great work, except I was working 100 hours a week. And I was doing that for 5 years, even including weekends. And I remember one night distinctly, I was walking to my car at 10 p.m. in a deserted parking garage, completely dark. And I was like, is this all there is to life? This, I'm just going to do this and I'm going to work and I'm going to die. I can't do this. This is crazy. And so I had just been married for a year and talked to my newlywed wife. And basically I had midlife crisis at 25. And so we bought a one-way ticket to Iceland and we got a backpack and we went for a year around the world. And I was legitimately trying to find myself and figure out what, you know, what did I want to make of my life? And so we were traveling and I remember we were laying on a beach in Bali, Indonesia. And I was reading a book by James Michener called The Drifters. And in it, there's a quote that says, Southern Florida is filled with people who wanted to do something big in their lives, but they waited until it was safe. Now it's safe and they're 68 years old and they live in Southern Florida. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to take risk. I am going to go back and, make my mark on the world. And so those two moments really defined me. Those were the epiphany moments.
Okay. So you had the midlife crisis at 25. That was good to get out of the way, you know?
Exactly. My wife appreciates that I didn't try it again at 50.
She's gone, oh, Larry's not going to have one. You know, he did that early on in life. Anyway, before we talk about the book itself, what prompted you then? Okay, you had this kind of pifty midlife, whatever you call it, crisis. But what prompted, and you went off around the world, right? But what mm-hmm. then prompted you to come back in, what was it, early 2000s and start a virtual organization way back then, pre-Skype, actually? Right. I mean, pre-Skype, pre-Apple iPhones and all that. What got into your head at the time?
Yeah. So as I said, I was really disillusioned with the work world and specifically how consulting was done. And so I had some like-minded friends. We had been at the same company and we talked about it and we're like, why? Why in the world does it have to be like this? Why do you have to kill people nonstop for profit? Why do you have to have politics? Why does business have to be boring? And so we said, if we had a blank sheet of paper, how could we get rid of all the things that we hate about consulting and keep all the things that we love? And we made that list. And, you know, one of the things we certainly wanted to do was have employee happiness. We wanted them to have good work-life balance. And as we brainstormed about that, one of the ideas that we came up with is, hey, we think our employees would be happier and have, you know, better balance in their lives if they could work remotely when they didn't have to be at the client site. And we're like, there's, you know, at the time it was unheard of. And so that was one of the premises that we started out with how the company was going to be different. And we you know, started out and we made it work. And it was not easy. Certainly the technology today makes it a ton easier. But it was possible back there. And we figured out all the things that everybody's been struggling with since the pandemic and trying to go remote. We figured those things out 20 years ago. And so I've been kind of chuckling as people would write all these articles of you can't innovate, you can't do all of this stuff. And I'm like, no, you can absolutely have an amazing culture. You can have happy people and you can be remote.
I'm going to get to we'll get to the technology a bit later on, I think. So something for our listeners to look forward to, because I think that you probably have some very useful advice and tips on that. So when we get to the book now, the book is titled Office Optional, How to Build a Connected Culture with Virtual Teams. Now, all those words, they matter. Eh? So, and I believe you started writing it before the coronavirus pandemic hit. And so in some ways, it kind of seems to have arrived at an opportune moment in terms of the theme of the book being something that was on everybody's mind. But the question I have for you is, did you change much about the approach to the book after so much of society went into this lockdown and the whole world went digital mad, trying to do remote work and that? So where were you at in the book when all this started happening around about February, March 2020?
Yeah, let me tell you the story of how I came up with this. So we would have to explain all the time to executives. I mean, let's say we were trying to sell to an executive and when I would say we were a virtual company and we had won all these awards for our culture, people would look at me with, you know, like I was a crazy madman. And I did this over and over again. They're like, I don't even understand how that's remotely possible. And so you get that question enough, and we could see the technology was getting better, and we thought it was going to be the future of work. We just thought it was 10, 15 years out. And so I said, you know what, I'm going to write this book. And I looked around, there was very little written about how to be remote and have a great culture. So I went to my main business partner. I was like, hey, I'm thinking writing this book. And he's like, that is the dumbest idea you've ever come up with. Don't do it. And I didn't listen to him. And so over a couple of years, I worked nights and weekends on this. And, you know, it was a labor of love to get it done. And I was finally done and getting ready to publish it. And the pandemic happened. And so it was completely accidental timing, obviously. And so from that moment on, I've been writing and speaking, and because obviously everybody wanted to know what are the secrets and how to do that. And the second part of your question is what has changed? Mm-hmm. Since the pandemic happened, we could talk a lot about that. Kind of summarizing it is the things that are in the original content of the book that were published prior to the pandemic, those hold true. Those are the core concepts in there are exactly what you want to do if you want to be remote and have a great culture. Now, what has been fascinating to me is, you know, when a need happens like that, everybody gets behind it and they innovate in all kinds of different ways. And so it's been fun for me to watch. I see the technology getting better. I see great ideas on how to provide connection when you're remote. And so it's the body of knowledge has just gotten better and better and more sophisticated, which I love to see. Now, we help a lot of companies with this. And what's been really interesting is there is still a group of people that are holdouts. And they are usually 50 to 60 year old executives that have had all their success in the office. And no matter how much data we give them and how much data, like if they pulled all their employees, they're like, yeah, I don't want to come into the office 5 days a week. They don't believe it. And so they have to really feel pain. And so I speak all the time, and I would say, I gave a speech, let's say last month, and there's a room of, let's say 150, 200 people. There was one company that had not adopted a hybrid or remote in there. So this is the way going forward. And I would just plead with people to get on board with that.
Yeah, it's an interesting work. I want to get to the generational thing in a few minutes, but because you mentioned a generational thing, I was thinking a few months back when there was all the articles were about return to the office, right? My eldest daughter had never worked in an office because exactly. She went in to do a master's degree during COVID, and she'd worked in a shop before, you know. And she was also writing songs and pursuing a little bit of music career at the time. So she never worked in an office. So there must be loads of people of that generation. The idea of return to what? Return to the office. What does that mean? Because they don't even have a reference point for an office in the way that somebody of, let's say, our age, you know, in that sort of post, around the 50-ish, post 50, would say, well, that's where you went to work, right? So it's interesting, but can we get to the generational thing in a few minutes? Because you describe the book as a roadmap to virtual work success. So now that we've identified that there's still holdouts out there, explain how the book can do this. Because one of the things I notice in the book is, whilst you are the author of the book, you weren't the only person which contributed content. And that makes this book very interesting because it's not just The World According to Larry, right? It's you got lots of great content in there from colleagues. So how does this book create a roadmap to virtual work success?
So I read a lot of business books, and sometimes it's so funny going through this process. I've read a lot of business books, and I was like, "Wow, that could be a PowerPoint," and but they made it 40,000 words. And so what I try to do is make it as digestible and easy to follow as an executive can with limited time, and try to lay out here are the key steps, and then even put a summary at the end. If you're skimming, then you're like, "This is not helpful. Let me just get the key 4 or 5 points." But it is meant to be so. Any company can do this. Any company can be successful. And there's steps that are well-traveled now that you can follow. And it's meant to lay those out. So You can absolutely be successful, as I said, but there's a lot to it. It's not just, hey, I installed Teams or I installed Zoom and I'm good. I'm remote now. It's people, it's your office strategy, or it's your gathering strategy, it's the technology. And you need to do those collectively together. And so it just kind of walks you through, how do I need to think about each of these sections and what are the things I need to do to tailor this to my organization?
Yeah. And it is a great, it does that very well, actually. I could identify with a lot of it. I was a little bit like you in the mid 2000s. I decided to start a consulting business remote, and people told me I was mad as well, but I was kind of lucky that Skype was just coming along. So it was easier to start connecting people. It kind of gave us the basic starting point, and you probably had to do a lot more work than that to get to that. But listen, one of the big challenges that you see a lot in the media is not the actual individual worker's challenge with working remotely. It's the whole management leadership aspect of it. So what skills do leaders need to be good at remote or hybrid leadership, in your opinion or your experience?
Yeah, let's talk about that, because I've written a couple articles about this. And what I would argue is the leadership techniques that were taught, you know, let's say after World War II and for the last 70 years are outdated, and they need to change. That body of knowledge needs to change because the environment's changed. And so if you look at today now, you have teams all over the world. You have teams that are virtual or hybrid, a mix. You have teams that spin up and down with freelancers. You have a generation that much more values, certainly in the United States, the generation that you just mentioned, wants work-life balance. And then you have this set of tools where you're now learning to work asynchronously, as different than how you work synchronously in the office. And so you put all of that together, and that is a new set, you know, that's a different environment, and you need new skills and new approaches to do that. And so, you know, I would give you, let's talk about some of the top things is, you know, especially if you are remote or hybrid, you have to lead a little bit differently. So what we like to do is we train our leaders to make sure that they prioritize relationship building. We want people to get more personal so that they build trust. We want them to foster connectedness, inclusion, and belonging. And so there's techniques that you can do to do that. So as an example, you want to check in more frequently, especially when you have remote workers. You want to lead with vulnerability as a leader because vulnerability is a shortcut to trust. And we want everybody to bring their whole self to work, meaning their personality and all the components of it, because when you understand and know somebody at a personal level, you connect with them a little bit easier. And what I would say is a good book that I read was, and have been trained on is 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership. And where that's going is really as a leader, understanding your emotion and how it drives you. And so you're much more aware of it, because I think when you're careful and you're aware of your emotions, you can be a much more effective leader. Those are just a few of the off the top of my head.
Now, a word from one of our sponsors. Are your remote workers performing as expected, or do they sometimes struggle? Do your managers have the necessary competencies to manage remote workers? Not everyone has adapted well to remote working. Yet one thing we know is that there's no going back, and remote and hybrid working are here to stay. Wide Circle can assess the remote working capabilities of your people so that those who struggle, including managers, can get the necessary training and support they need to perform at their best wherever they're working. To learn more, go to www.widecircle.eu/remote-working or simply click on the link in the show notes. Now, back to Larry.
Yeah, and in the book you unpack a lot more of that and give examples of things that help do that for leaders. Yeah, I think that for people brought up, as you talked about, that generation who are now in their 50s and maybe beyond, the whole concept of being vulnerable as a leader, like you were supposed to be Superman or Superwoman, and you know you weren't supposed to have a chink in your armor. And yet Confucius once said, if you think you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room. So and I've talked to CEOs who were very successful, and they've told me that was their guiding principle. You know, bring out the best, make sure you've got great people in the room, but bring out the best in them. The difference now is the rooms are virtual, right? So you have to find other ways to do that. But let's talk about this, because I've heard you talk about also the idea, well, trust comes out very strongly in the book and what you say, but you also talk about access to global talent. Tell me a little bit about your experience of that.
Sure. So what has happened and what makes me so optimistic about virtual work is it makes it no longer physically dependent. And so there's this amazing opportunity to access talent anywhere in the world. And so it's no longer trying to access the talent, the best talent within a 30-mile radius of your corporate headquarters. It's where are the best talent in the world. And so it's really interesting. If you look at the startups today, they have no office space. Everything is in the cloud, and they hire from anywhere in the world. And so you're competing against that. And if you're not getting on board with that, you're going to be in trouble. The humanitarian side of it, which I think is awesome and fascinating, is now you can access talent in parts of the world that you could never access before, and you're going to give opportunity to people in those regions as well. So I'm excited to see where all of this goes, but you know, it becomes much more of a global talent market.
I see it even through some of the platforms out there like Fiverr and others, where you see this very dynamic, young, well-educated, smart people who can do really cool work. I've worked with some people through those platforms, and what they've done for me has been, and I readily will top up what they ask for, because you know it's amazing what they're capable of.
So one of the, you have asked me since the pandemic, I predicted that the freelance movement would accelerate a lot faster than it has. Mm-hmm. At least at the corporate level, I have not seen the adoption around freelancers as much as I thought would happen since the pandemic. And so there's a number of reasons for that. I still think it's important, but I haven't seen the mass adoption yet.
Right. How do you deal with things like fairness? If two people are doing the same job and one person is getting paid, I mean, I suppose you have to have some rules around purchase power parity or some sort of normalization to say to people, well, you're actually getting well paid if you're not, even if you're not living. Because I think some companies are struggling with traditional companies. How do you know? You see a lot of commentary about, so you've moved out of whatever, Chicago or New York, and you're living in some nice little town somewhere in the Midwest. Therefore, you don't deserve the salary you got in wherever. So even within countries, but how do you deal with that? I mean, what's your experience of dealing with those conversations that may occur around that?
Yeah, so it's been fascinating to watch it play out. Because we even saw this. We lost some people to Silicon Valley because they're like, hey, I'm going to pay, you know, they're in the Midwest, and they're like, I'm going to pay you a Silicon Valley salary. And so what I see is a hybrid still. And so companies that have, you know, strong geographic presence in cities usually pay to the right salary by role for that city. But I do see a lot of corporations saying, we're going to pay this role, no matter where you're at in the country, we're going to pay this salary. I increasingly see a lot more of that as those companies become much more mixed, as you said.
Yeah. Now, I'm not living in Ireland anymore. I mean, I live in Belgium, but I see this happening in Ireland now there was already a digitalization strategy going on to improve broadband, but you're seeing more and more focus on moving people out of a couple of main cities, partly because property prices have gone crazy because of supply and demand issues and that. And like, if people don't have to travel every day to an office, the commute when they need to go can be achieved within a reasonable time frame and that. So, yeah, that's a very interesting thing. I presume that will continue to evolve now, those conversations about how to do that.
Well, it's causing remaking of the cities, at least in the United States. In a lot of cities, commercial real estate's in big trouble because people are not coming downtown, and there's a whole economy that thrives around that. And so you're seeing people go to the suburbs and recreate all those services in the suburbs. And there's a huge tax hole now in the cities. And so you're going to see remaking of how cities operate as a result of remote work.
Maybe it's time to ask. In the early part of the book, you quote Richard Branson. You say, he said, in 30 years' time, as technology moves forward even further, people are going to look back and wonder why offices ever existed. I'm not sure when he wrote that quote, but what will replace the office as a community space for co-workers? And can everything be done online, or will we still need to meet in person?
Thank you for that question. So we've experimented with this over the years many times, and what we still tell everybody, even if you're 100% remote companies, and there's companies that do the 100% remote and they never see each other. But I would say the most effective way is you still get together face to face from time to time. And we call it gathering strategy. What's your gathering strategy for your company? But what we know is when we get everybody to get together in person, there is a energy level that you cannot recreate online that people feel, and they get re-energized and excited, and they deepen their relationships that you formed. As an example, we get everybody in the United States together two or three times a year, 100% of the people in person, and then we have other groups that get together at different times. That is still really critical. I think you're going to have a much healthier, stronger, deeper culture if you can afford to do that and design that in that face-to-face into your overall structure of your company.
Right. And I guess you're light on the whole corporate-y stuff then. It's more, as you mentioned earlier on, it's all about building these relationships. Because often when companies do these things, they lock people in rooms for hours to work. To get the value out of the away time and that.
The number one purpose when we get together is about networking and building relationships. Yes, we do some work and we disseminated stuff, but that is by far, that's what you're doing. And so we design everything around deepening connections. That's the most important thing that we're doing.
Right. By the way, listeners, when I asked Larry that question, his head, he was shaking it, saying, absolutely not. So this is maybe a nice segue into, what do you mean by a connected culture? And what makes a great connected culture? And I know that you guys have won at Centric, have won lots of awards, despite being this, in the past, this remote organization. So tell our listeners a bit about what you've learned over the years that makes a truly connected culture.
Sure. So the way you would be able to identify it is, let's say we just talked about our face-to-face meeting. If you came to that as an outside observer, you would be blown away with the laughter, the camaraderie, it's like a long lost family reunion. There's so much excitement and energy getting together. And we have such deep relationships across the company that, you know, all the studies that have been done about the highest performing teams, the ones that trust each other the most and have those great relationships and can have those hard, honest conversations with each other, those teams outperform every, you know, it's not even close. And so we have that level of relationship and that level of connection, even though, you know, somebody's in Miami and somebody's in Seattle. And there's a lot of work that we've done to build that, or, you know, but that's what it feels like. And that's what it means to be connected, is it is that level of relationship, connections all between each other, that drives this really great performance. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And even as you talk, I'm thinking of some of my previous guests like Paul Zak, and I think about Craig Weber, Conversational Capacity, and all these guys who talk about how to help people improve the ability to deepen those relationships and sometimes have tough conversations, but how the emotional side of Paul Zak talks a lot about oxytocin and how a lot of, you know, when people feel good, they're going to perform better, etc.
Yeah, the other part to add to this that the listeners might be asking is, okay, how do you have a consistent culture when you've got everybody spread out and you've got different groups that are all over the place? And so when we started to grow, I actually went out and I studied that, and I tried to figure out where were the companies that had scaled that had been able to maintain their culture, and what was the secret? And the secret was, if you have leaders that embody your culture and they lead with your value system and your culture, you can scale the company to any size that you want. And so for us, it's really critical that we train everybody in our culture. So when a new hire comes in, they actually, within the first, you know, month or two, they go to culture training class, basically. And it's either in person, it's been virtual since COVID, but it is, you know, it is multiple sessions where we're imparting and it's fun. We're sharing the stories, so people understand what the culture is and they can protect it. And then the leadership development training that we do, we've actually tailored it so that, you know, you can teach anybody the basics of leadership skills, but how to lead with our value system and how do you do that so that you're reinforcing our culture. So you got to do all of those things to make sure that you have that consistent culture.
Yeah. So I think that's great advice for our listeners out there. I suppose some of them might be also wondering or thinking, well, are there industries or businesses that you think will never go virtual?
Yeah, so I get this question a lot around, it's more, let's say if I'm in manufacturing or healthcare, and you have haves and have-nots, and does that create tension in your organization? Mm-hmm. And so as an example, we've done the work for, let's say it's a global manufacturing company that everybody would recognize the brand name and the product. And they took, you know, they still have manufacturing. You have to obviously be there in person to do manufacturing, but all their back office, everybody else is largely virtual. And you would worry that there's going to be this tension that I mentioned, and it doesn't, because it doesn't happen, because people are like, oh, this is my job and this is how I'm adding value. This is their job and this is how they're signing up to add value. And by reducing costs, by not having office space, that is good. And so we don't see that level of resentment. Same thing, excuse me, in the healthcare space, docs being in person or nurses, well, the group that runs the rest of the administration of the hospital, they can be more remote and they can reduce costs by having less office space. We do not see that have and have not tension at all. So And even in the manufacturing, you can do things like you can take a group of people and design their role so that maybe one day a week they're off doing this type of work that doesn't require me to be physically in person. There's all kind of tricks that you can do. So, you know, yes, there are some things that physically you have to be there as a company, and that's not going to change. But even then, we've been experimenting with some of the virtual reality stuff. It is amazing. So you can have a technician halfway around the world that can be right there with you as you're working on the machine. And so we're going to even see changes like that. But I think you will increasingly see more. Richard Branson's going to be right. You're just going to see more and more people as the technology gets better moving away from the confines of an office.
So you talk about the digital transformation of the workplace, and I, if I'm not mistaken, this seems to be what Centric itself as a consulting firm has been doing a lot of work in. So how has the shift to hybrid working also impacted growth in your own consulting business? Because if you've been doing that, have you seen a spike in this in the last couple of years?
So there's two components to that. One is during COVID and after COVID, every company realized they needed to have how they digitally transacted was really important, and many were way behind the eight ball. And so you've seen almost every company say, holy crap, if I'm going to survive, I need to be a digital company. And so that's created a huge body of work. Same thing with hybrid, where, you know, everybody's like, I need the tools to do this. And so we have a practice that does that. The thing that was interesting is we thought there would be tons of companies that wanted our help with the stuff that we've been talking about, which is, how do I operate hybrid? How do I get all these things right about culture and all that kind of stuff? We haven't done that much of that. I mean, we've done a fair amount, but I thought it was going to be explosive, and it wasn't. And it's really interesting because the vast majority of people are like, I don't need help. This is easy. I'll figure this out. And so we've done far less of that, and we've continued to see less and less demand as people have kind of gotten their sea legs and they've figured out how to do this. But the digital transformation work is huge, and it's going to that's every company's a technology company now, whether they want to be or not, if they want to survive. And so that plays in our sweet spot.
Yeah, and you speak about four generations in the workforce. So we talked about it a bit earlier on. But what are the tools, just now that we get into the digitalization, what are the types of tools that organizations need to embrace to accommodate the digital communication styles of each generation? In the final part of our conversation, Larry talks about the four generations in the workforce, how to approach using remote working tools, how virtual and augmented reality are likely to impact the world of work, and he concludes with some useful tips and a special offer for you. So lots still to look forward to.
Sure. So I would recommend that we see companies install too many tools at once, and employees were confused. We'd recommend one, collaboration tool. We use Teams as an example. You can use Zoom, or you can use Slack, or whatever you want to use. But having a tool that breaks down the silos so everybody can see the communication. And then there's different ways, like we talked about with generations, that you can use to communicate based on what's important to you. Although we see everybody kind of, even all the generations, migrating to much more consistent use of the tool so that they asynchronously communicate, because the best companies that get good at this learn how to use those tools asynchronously, because that's best how remote workers work. I saw a proliferation of tools that like tried to recreate the office in the virtual world, like where you had to go knock on the door and go sit in their desk, in front of their desk and stuff like that. That is not how it works. Adopting the tools like we just talked about are really important. Generationally, you hit on this, and I want to talk about this. We've studied the different generations, and we've done focus groups. And it's fascinating, like your daughter and my son, that generation that started work virtually, they want they value flexibility above all else. And so they like to come to the office, but they want to come to the office to build relationships. And they want the flexibility that they were given when they started out. They don't want to go back into the office 5 days a week. Baby boomers, they are like, hey, I'm getting close to retirement. I'll do whatever you want. It's okay. Right. I'll come in or I'll do it virtually. And then that generation Gen X that we talked about, those are the ones that are having the most difficulty breaking free from the reins of the office because they've had all their success there. As an example, you know, there's hoteling, the hoteling concept where you don't have a, you know, you have a different desk when you come in.
Yeah.
We interview them and they're like, where am I going to put my awards? You know, I need my own desk space, kind of thing. And so that generation is still struggling, but they're coming along a little bit.
Mm. Because you asked this wonderful question. How many of your teenage kids actually answer the phone when it rings? I'm living that. And then when they do phone, they say, where are you? My train has just arrived. And you go, I tried to phone you 10 minutes ago. Oh, really? It's kind of funny. And what they do is they record messages in WhatsApp and they send them to their friends and they wait for the friend to record a message and send it back. And I go, would it not be faster to just exchange the verbals in thing? But I've seen studies that show that young teenagers find phoning and taking phone calls and making phone calls very stressful. Apparently, there's been some research done on that. The concept of email as well is like, what are they for? You know, what do we need emails for? And so I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going on out there. And it's I think it requires an open-mindedness to at least explore and embrace it, to understand it, rather than trying to fight against it, no?
Oh, 100%. And the modes are going to change even further. So as I mentioned, we've been experimenting with virtual AR and VR, and the tools that are out there today. It's going to provide a completely different modality that everybody's going to have to learn how to do because it's coming and the technology is getting better and better and it's going to be real.
So give our listeners maybe one or two examples of how AR or VR might come down the line next year or two to affect how the hybrid virtual workspace is improving.
Yeah. So what we would say is in the examples of the use cases around manufacturing where, you know, job aides and training people and having a remote technician helping you, those are very real today and very valuable. Mm-hmm. The idea of, hey, you and I are going to, instead of meeting, you know, on a two-dimensional screen, we're actually going to put on headsets and we're going to meet in a conference room where, you know, for virtual 3D image rendering, that's further off. It's still glitchy. I got a headache. I got a little motion sick doing it. You definitely feel more present. It's pretty amazing, but it still has a little ways to go. So I don't think we're going to see that in the next year.
Okay. Okay, I think you're having the ability to have the technician who's sitting somewhere else. I guess you could probably even hand over control at some stage to some panels that there, and at least you can see the output of what's coming on, and maybe say, no, that's not working, or that. So that's probably fascinating. A lot of people might not realize that that could be a very, very valuable application for some form of augmented or virtual reality. So coming to the end. What are some key insights that you could share with the listeners based on your experience? Perhaps a few do's and don'ts around, you know, so let's say you're an organization has, of course, we all had to basically go through this pandemic thing and that, but some organizations are probably thinking, well, now it's over, business as usual, but many others are trying to get it, let's say, inverted commas, right, you know, this virtual thing. So what are some of the do's and don'ts that you have discovered over the years that you could just leave our listeners with a couple of, and maybe even something that they could just go out and test out tomorrow even, you know, they could get a team together and talk about it and say, we're thinking, what about if we did a couple of these things or whatever. So kind of to round out the conversation, perhaps a couple of insights.
Yeah, sure. So one of the don'ts, if you're at the company level, is don't monitor your employees. There's tools that you can use to see if they're sitting at their desk or and putting these strict rules around when they need to be at their desk. Please, please do not do that. You're taking away trust and you're taking away the power and the flexibility of remote work that employees love so that they can kind of design their day and what energizes them. You're going to be much more successful. And there's been lots of studies done. The problem is people work too much in a remote world. It's not that they're not working. So please don't do that. And then on the remote side, if you're trying to build connection and culture, get personal. That is the key. And so a simple thing that you can do is at the start of any of a meeting that you're about to do, a virtual meeting, ask a question that gets everybody to talk personally about themselves so that everybody can open up and share who they are and what they're all about, because that's going to immediately start you on your way to building those connections.
Mm. I've noticed that happening where at the very early stages of this, because we've done business with clients, we never met them, you know, at the early stages during the pandemic. But what I noticed was there has been a tangible move away from transactional to more relationship building. So it used to be people would just jump into the call and it was like, okay, what are we here for? Now there's more, even if it's only the classic, how's the weather where you are? Actually, that's a very interesting question, because today people are coming in from all over the world. So how the weather is quite an interesting question. Whereas it used to be a kind of filler question. In Ireland, if you don't get asked how the weather is, it's a sign that the person might not like you, you know? So if they ask you how the weather is, it's a great starting point for a conversation, even though everybody knows, because it's either raining or it's not, you know. So anyway, Larry, is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask you that you want to share with our viewers, or sorry, our listeners, before we finish?
No, I thought you did a great job with all of your questions. Thank you.
Okay, so I believe you might have a special offer for some of our lucky listeners, and also, how do people get in contact with you? So maybe that's a combined thing.
Sure.
Yeah. How would you like people to reach out to you after this?
Yeah. So you can find all of my content and connections on LarryEnglish.net. And yes, the first three people that reach out to me on LinkedIn, I will gladly send them a signed copy of the book.
Larry, it's been a real pleasure. I'm so grateful that you were able to free up some time to do this conversation with me. And I really, on behalf of the listeners, I'd like to thank you for sharing your insights, your tips, and all that wisdom with our listeners today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode. You'll find details of what we covered in the show with links, etc., in the show notes. Please share your key takeaways from today's guest and let your friends and colleagues know about the podcast. Oh, and if there's a particular author or leading thinker you'd like me to interview, just get in touch and I'll do my best to get them on the show. This episode was brought to you by Wide Circle, helping you make better talent decisions. To learn more, visit widecircle.eu. That's widecircle.eu. Until next time.